So, hi. I'm really happy to be here. It's been really fun. Nikolaos asked me to give a couple talks while I'm here, so I'll give one this afternoon and another tomorrow. And the one today is, Nikolaos suggested that it might be helpful to give a sort of overview of the kinds of genomics approaches which are available and which people are applying in C. elegans, to give you an idea of the kind of data that's out there. And we can talk more at another time about some of the more technical issues about the quality of the different data sets and how to find them. And I think you can all click around and discover where to, you know, download data sets if you want to do some data mining. But I thought it would be useful to give a sort of overview of and you've heard several talks about C. elegans by now, especially people who have been here for a few weeks. But to review sort of there's been sort of a linear progression, I would say, in terms of the choice of C. elegans as a model organism and its current sort of development and as a sort of like a systems biology model for development, which maybe Sidney Brenner wouldn't like. I don't think he likes that term very much. But I think that you'll see, hopefully, that there has been a very logical progression in this way. And instead of calling it a model organism, Fabio started calling it a reference species recently, and I think that that's a really good thing to think about, because we're not going to be doing all of the functional studies and all the organisms that we're going to have genomic sequences available for, but we do need reference organisms in which we have a lot of experimental data. And so Eric, for instance, was talking about his analyses of these two component systems, and I think that if he has the right kind of information, he can make extremely good predictions, but you need at least, you know, some reference systems in which you have done an experimental analysis to collect good enough data that you can use to judge the quality of your methods. And these things are very complementary and will help in the long run to feed each other. So, and I'm not going to go to all the places and show you where you can get all the kinds of data, and we can again talk about that later. But I thought what I would do is also show you a few examples of the kinds of things people were trying to do, how the data were collected, and what kinds of problems they were working on. So I hope it's the right kind of, we'll see. Nikolaos just told me that people walked out on Newton's talks and he was kept giving the talk all by himself, so I felt better, no matter what happens. Okay, so Sidney Brenner, I think many of you probably know, chose this organism in the 60s as a model for the next phase of what he considered to be important biology. And I'm going to give you a few excerpts from the beginning of C. elegans' book, because I found it, I was rereading it yesterday, this book that Fabio had, and I thought it was actually extremely interesting. So I have a few slides like this, and I think that it's useful to go back and realize what people were thinking about at the time. So he states in the preface of this book, he goes, "In late 1962, Francis Crick and I began a long series of conversations about the next steps to be taken in our research. Both of us felt very strongly that most of the classical problems of molecular biology had been solved in 1962, and that the future lay in tackling more complex biological problems. As I put it in a draft paper, we must move on to other problems of biology which are new, mysterious, and exciting. Broadly speaking, the fields which we should now enter are development and the nervous system." So the system was chosen specifically to study these problems and to try to get at them in a very rigorous and systematic and quantitative way. So he was at the MRC and he was searching around for his next line of research, and he wrote a letter to Max Perutz early in 1963 describing some of his thoughts about which directions to go in. And he reiterates a little bit some of what was in the last slide, but I'll just read it to you. He goes, "It is now widely realized that nearly all the classical problems of molecular biology have either been solved or will be solved in the next decade." And so now we're 2007 still. I think we have a few things to do, hopefully, left. "I have long felt that the future of molecular biology lies in the extension of research to other fields of biology, notably development and the nervous system," again. "This is not an original thought, because as you well know, many other molecular biologists are thinking the same way. The great difficulty about these fields is that the nature of the problem has not been clearly defined, and hence the right experimental approach is not known." And so you have to remember at this time, people were characterizing bacteriophage and bacteria, and they had really tried to understand the control mechanisms in these organisms. So he goes on and he goes, "There's a lot of talk about control mechanisms and very little more than that. It seems to me that both in development and in the nervous system, one of the serious problems is our inability to define unitary steps of any given process. It is possible that the repressor operator theory of Jacob and Bonneau will be the central clue, but there's not very much to suggest that this is so, at least in its simple form. There may well be insufficient information of the right kind to generate a central idea, and what we may require at the present is an extension of experimentation into these problems. The experimental approach that I would like to follow is to attempt to define the unitary steps in development using the techniques of genetic analysis, because these were the techniques which had been powerful up to that point in time. And I think it's worthwhile to note that people had been working on fly genetics already for at least 50 years or more at the time that he was thinking about this. So flies had already come into, had already been being developed as an experimental system for development. So then in his proposal in October, he goes, in summary, it is probably true to say that no major discovery comparable in importance to that of, say, mRNA now lies ahead in this field. But the detailed elucidation of the mechanisms already discovered is nevertheless vital. 1963. The new major problem in molecular biology is the genetics and biochemistry of control mechanisms in cellular development. We propose to start work in this field and gradually make it the division's main research. And then I'm just going to show a couple more slides about the model organism that he selected. So in the appendix, he says differentiation in a nematode worm. So he was trying to look for the right organism. He spent quite a lot of time looking at different kinds of organisms and trying to find one that would fit the criteria that he was that he had for an organism that could be used in this way. So he goes, part of the success of molecular genetics was due to the use of extremely simple organisms which could be handled in large numbers, bacteria and bacterial viruses. The processes of genetic replication and transcription, a genetic recombination and mutagenesis, and the synthesis of enzymes could be studied there in their most elementary form, and having once been discovered, their applicability to the higher forms of life could be tested afterwards. We should like to tackle the problem of cellular development in a similar fashion, choosing the simplest possible differentiated organism and subjecting it to the analytical methods of microbial genetics. Thus, we want a multicellular organism which has a short life cycle, can be easily cultivated, and is small enough to be handled in large numbers like a microorganism. It should have relatively few cells so that exhaustive studies of lineage and patterns can be made and should be amenable to genetic analysis. And by the way, and so he goes, we think we have a good candidate in the form of a small nematode worm, C. briggsi, which he misspells. which is, by the way, transparent, as you know, throughout the life cycle, so it's very easy to study optically, and you can actually follow this lineage. He then switched later to C. elegans, which was collected in a compost pile in Bristol, and convinced someone to do a lot of electron micrographs to look at the anatomy of this organism. So he continues, although the total number of cells is only about 1,000, so that's the somatic cells, the organism is differentiated and has all of the basic tissue types that we know to exist in higher metazoan. So epidermis, intestine, excretory system, nerves, and muscle cells. So he says, to start with, we propose to identify every cell in the worm and trace lineages. We shall also investigate the constancy of development and study its genetic control by looking for mutants. Okay, so by now I think you've all seen this diagram a few times. And so the major question is, how do we get from here? I'm not exactly sure, but at first there was some confusion as to which ones they were actually looking at because they actually look very similar. and he had a sample that someone gave him of elegans that was growing well in the lab, and that they were trying to do some experiments to try to define define culture media that they could grow these things in. And actually still there isn't a really particularly good defined culture media. So you can make oxytrose and things like this. And someone had already started to do this kind of work in C. elegans.
How does a nematologist go about defining this as elegans? What is the test?
So I think there are subtle morphological differences, particularly in the male tail, that people look at to try to distinguish species. And they look at various things like rates of defecation and other parameters that they can easily measure visually to try to distinguish them from each other. Because morphologically, they're quite similar. I'm not a nematologist, so I don't know exactly.
But they don't cross at all.
And they don't interbreed, yeah.
Right, but I mean, let's say you get a new guy.
Now you do molecular analysis, right? But at that time, they didn't have the molecular phylogeny.
So, have been done in, for example, in other species?
No, but it's something which I think is on the horizon, because now, as Fabio was mentioning this morning, this guy named Bao has, in Bob Waterston's lab, developed a very nice lineaging system. And so I was going to just, so the original lineage took about, I think it was 4,000 hours, they said, of person work. And now you can relineage using this automated system in just a couple hours, I think. Is that right? So let's say a few hours to days, I think you can repeat this work. So Bao actually repeated the lineage study that had been done and found that it was completely correct, except for one error which had previously been corrected already. And the fact that this system now works in C. elegans, if you can, but it's helpful to have, and I think requires still at this point, fluorescent markers to be able to track the nuclei effectively. And it's quite challenging once you get a very large number of nuclei, but up to the early stages at least, it's much easier. So if you can make a transgenic Briggsy with a nice nuclear marker, you should be able then to easily lineage Briggsy. So I imagine something that will soon be accomplished.
There's a little bit of lineage stuff in sublineages, right?
In sublineages and in early...
Relics, for example, is that a little bit more, a few comparisons, but not the whole animal.
But I guess even sort of the first four doublings or five doublings.
Sure, sure. So Fabio described this morning that people have, certainly done those things by hand, right? But to recapitulate the entire lineage is quite difficult and laborious.
So maybe I can ask a question slightly differently.
Are there examples comparing different norms?
So there are some differences in lineage. So as Fabio was saying, some people study this in specific cell types. So for example, in the vulva, people have studied quite extensively. So Paul Sternberg and disciples and other people have looked at, compared the divisions of the patterns of divisions and differentiation.
That is somehow near that specific organ,
right.
Somewhere near the bottom.
Right.
But if you just start from the top.
So if you look, for example, at timing, right at the beginning, at different cell cycle time, same temperature, different species, 5 to 10 times different cell cycle times. And if you then ask questions like, so there are asynchronous divisions that we were showing you, and in C. elegans, AB divides always a little bit ahead of P1. In other species, it's the other way around. And then I showed you cases of whether there's spindle orientation or not reorientation. Those are things that happen right away. And so it can happen. And there's another division which it's on the P lineage, which is in fact, again, the P actually gets a reversal of polarity in some whole bunch of species. That reversal of polarity doesn't happen. So there's all kinds of things.
And also there are the quite nice, I would say, vulval studies on vulval development, which have different patterns of orientation of the cell divisions and duplications of cell types and things like that. Did that answer your question? We can talk more about it later, I guess. So I think most of you know then that this work was awarded the Nobel Prize a few years ago. So this is Sidney Brenner, who chose the organism, and John Sulston, who with his colleagues worked out the lineage, and Bob Horvitz, who characterized genes involved in cell death. So when the lineage was being worked on, it was realized that some of the cells in the animal normally undergo a programmed cell death. And they identified mutants in this, and he worked out this pathway, which is now known to be conserved throughout metazoa, and a very important feature of development. Okay. So we're still trying to ask this question, but I think the organism really was chosen to try to answer this question. And in 1998, when the genome sequence was completed, and it was actually refined for a few years afterward, but now they have down to every last base, as Fabio mentioned this morning, people are still working out completing and refining the annotation of the functional elements in the genome, and gene predictions are still changing a little bit because exons get joined together or split apart, and so we don't have a completely 100% correct catalog of the functional elements, but we're certainly coming close. But what was recognized at the time the genome was sequenced and the first set of gene predictions went through, and it was recognized that there are about 20,000 genes in this organism, that only about 7% of the genes had been characterized genetically and cloned in 30 years of work by the community. So it was obvious that we needed additional methods to try to functionally annotate the genes in the genome in order to understand what's going on in development. And so in the last few years, people have developed a lot of high throughput techniques to try to characterize different aspects of gene function in this organism, as well as, and of course people are applying these techniques to other organisms as well, as many of you know. And so I'm going to go through some of these different types of information and give some examples of the kinds of work that people have been doing in C. elegans. And then, of course, we want to try to put all this back together and make some sense of development in the end. So in a few years ago, Stuart Kim, who spoke here recently, had a little review in Nature Genetics where he sort of coined this HTTP C. elegans, which is not a real website. I don't think you can go there. But it was just a concept of that the philosophy from the beginning was to try to characterize everything in a very systematic way. And there was a very close-knit community of researchers working on C. elegans who had a tradition of sharing data freely and sharing resources. And they had, as we were talking this morning, had even a worm breeders gazette where they were people published only unpublished data. The community has gotten a little large now, and so the gazette has sort of fallen by the wayside. But there is still a tradition of trying to create very good resources for data sharing and content. And so there are a lot of resources now on the web where you can go and learn about C. elegans biology and available data on genome annotation and different kinds of functional genomic studies. And so we have a little review in this worm book. There's an online book called wormbook.org, which if you're interested in C. elegans, I encourage you to go to. And we have a review in this. And this is the website, and you can learn all kinds of different aspects about C. elegans biology and husbandry and experimental techniques. And we have a review in here that has, you know, sort of a compendium of different kinds of resources for functional genomics and C. elegans. And if you want, you can go there and check more of that out. Okay, so back to the problem of what is required to make an animal or a specific tissue or a specific developmental program. You need to understand a variety of different factors. And so following on the original methodology, you need to understand what is the in vivo function of genes, what is the genetic requirement of genes in the genome. And we know that in yeast and in C. elegans and probably in other organisms, and I'll come back to this point later, that only some fraction of the genes are lethal when you knock them out one at a time, say 15 to 25%. So there's quite a lot of work to do to try and understand the functions of all these other genes with respect to development. And you want to understand where and when all the different genes are expressed and localized during development. You want to understand how the regulatory programs are established and maintained, and what are the sets of physical components that are present and operating in any particular cell type. So Fabio talked this morning about single gene knockdown sort of RNAi screens. So I'm not really going to go over this again, except to say that people have now gone through the genome several times using available libraries for RNAi and examined gross morphological phenotypes and a variety of other much more specific phenotypic analyses according to their specific interests. And now I think there will be a shift in focus of trying to understand genetic interactions between components during development. And we can take a cue from work that's been done in yeast, where there are deletion alleles for each of the 6,000 genes that are barcoded, and there are also promoter replacements for all of the lethal genes. And so people have been able to do systematic studies where they take a panel of genes and cross them to other genes in a pairwise combination and look for pairs that cause synthetic lethality or synthetic sickness, where each allele alone would not cause the animal to die by itself. And what?
The animal.
The organism. The single cell non-developmental model organism. And It's like the fish versus the sheep thing in the previous talk. So one of the lessons that come out of this is that it seems that lethal-lethal pairs and non-lethal pairs have a higher rate of interactions. So lethal-lethal pairs mean you make knockdowns of the two genes which are lethal when you knock them out completely. And that genetic interactions appear to be orthogonal in some way to physical interactions. And so the rationale for this is that if you have a linear pathway where A talks to B physically and B physically talks to C, that if you knock any one of those members out of the pathway, then you've basically broken the pathway, so you don't see genetic interactions between those guys. But any member of the same pathway will show very similar patterns of genetic interactions with components of other pathways. And most of the time you find that genetic interactions occur between related processes, and then there are sometimes some more general sort of effects that you tend to see. And this study by Devarwala, they used these promoter replacements to examine lethal genes and then put together a compendium of the studies they did with the essential genes and a previous SGA analysis from Charlie Bloom's group. And they came to this conclusion, and this just illustrates this idea that essential-essential pairs have a higher rate of synthetic lethality or sickness, followed by these essential, non-essential pairs. And then they tried to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation to project what the total number of interactions is going to be, and they estimate that there are around 200,000 genetic interactions in yeast. And yeast has only 6,000 genes, whereas C. elegans has 20,000, and humans have on the same order of magnitude. But we know that probably most genetic diseases in humans and are probably due to multigenic factors. And so we're very interested, and we really need to understand relationships between genes. So for C. elegans, knocking out one at a time 20,000 genes is doable, but doing all pairwise combinations or all triplets is really astronomically, you know, it's combinatorially, I think, experimentally infeasible. So that means that making predictions about probable genetic interactions to prioritize candidate lists for things that you can actually go about doing assays for is becoming an important thing. So computational analyses, yes? So in this case, the definition is that when you have a mutation or a specific allele in one gene, it doesn't show any phenotype on its own. And neither does the other gene on its own. But when you put them in combination together in the same cell, that cell either dies or is very sick and can't grow very fast.
So there are some, mathematically speaking, epsilons and deltas here. So when you say
Yeah. So you have to have a model that's, you know, more than additive, that's multiplicative, or something, or you can say that you think that you have a significant effect. Yeah, but in the case where neither one is dead alone, it's a life or death thing. So neither one by itself has any phenotype at all, and you put them together and the animal's dead. That's...
But the definition of an essential gene...
That's right. So to do the studies with the essential genes, you have to use promoter replacements where you reduce the function, but you don't completely obliterate the function. And in that case, you have to have models that you believe about whether you're detecting a significant difference and not just something that's additive and unrelated. And people do that.
Somehow, it makes me very uncomfortable. So by the time I have a small perturbation of an essential gene and I compare it to a large perturbation of perhaps less essential gene or unessential gene, you know, what is essential, what is inessential?
So I guess if you want to be quantitative about it, you can measure the amount of perturbation that you're making in your essential gene, right? It may be that you can achieve a very low level without completely knocking it out. But there's no other way to do that experiment. And we can go and look at the data together if you like and see if you feel comfortable with the conclusions. But I mean, there are experimental caveats in that regard. And some of the effects are a little bit nonspecific. And so in C. elegans, one of the things we're trying to do is, you know, repeat some of these kinds of things, but look for enhancers or suppressors. And when people do genetic screens and using candidates that are, say, things which have criteria that might implicate them as being higher priority for having such effect, you often get different results when you do an enhancement versus suppression. Suppression can be often more specific than an enhancement. So an analogy that some people make is, hey, if you cut off your leg and then you cut off your arm and then you cut off, you know, some other part of your body, eventually you just die because you have accumulated like a lot of deleterious mutations, let's say, right? So you're not looking for those things, so you have to go back and do more specific things later. And you can also look at the patterns. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about genetics, except in the context of other kinds of studies. To understand where and when genes are expressed, in order to understand the developmental regulatory programs, you want to make a catalog of expression profiles. So there are two different platforms that have been developed in C. elegans. One uses cDNAs and uses comparative hybridization approach of, say, wild type versus some other mutants or something like that. And then the affymetrix arrays just measure absolute levels of messenger RNA in different tissues. And quite a lot of these studies have been done, I would say several hundred or over 1,000 probably now. And I'll talk about some of these in a minute. People are also making all kinds of different reporter constructs in vivo, and Fabio showed examples of those this morning, where you can look at the lineage and you can look at the expression patterns in the adults. And there are different kinds of reporters that you can use, one of which is just to make a GFP reporter that you hook up to a specific promoter, and then you can see in which tissues that promoter drives activity of the reporter. You can make GFP protein fusions, and in that case, this allows you to look at the subcellular localization of where that protein goes. And then you can also make constructs with, say, a 3' UTR hooked up to its promoter and look to see what kinds of effects the 3' UTR has relative to an exogenous 3' UTR. And Fabio is going to talk about some of this work next week that's been going on in our group. And then you can take all of this stuff and try to put it together and do some kinds of global analyses in these. So I'll give examples, a little example of each of these different kinds of things. So Valerie Reinke pioneered the development of microarrays in C. elegans in Stuart Kim's lab as a postdoc. And what she was interested in was a germline development. And so most of these comparative studies have some kind of experimental design of this type, where she compared animals that were mutant animals that made, for example, only sperm or only made oocytes, and then compared those, or created mutants that had no germline whatsoever, but were hermaphrodites, so you compare the germline-less hermaphrodites to wild type, or males which have a germline or don't have a germline. You can compare them all to each other. And so what she wanted to identify was genes that were important for oogenesis versus intrinsic germline development. And she did a time course across larval and adult development. So in the larva, the gonad starts to form in L3 and L4. You have proliferation of these cells. And then they start to differentiate as they move away from this tip here. And first the animal makes spermatocytes and then switches to oocyte production and then can self-fertilize these as the eggs move through the spermatheca, which Fabi also showed this morning. And so what Valerie did was she characterized the expression of different genes that come on at different times during development or are present or absent in these different conditions. And she also found trends that are very similar to what Fabio discussed this morning. So for example, genes on the X chromosome are highly underrepresented in the germline, and these genes also tend to have a very high rate of embryonic lethal or sterile genes in them. And so we in fact used these sets of genes in early RNAi experiments where we were trying to understand what's important for embryogenesis to enrich for genes that are important in that stage. And then after about 500 of these microarray studies were completed in the Kim lab, Stuart Kim and colleagues published this compendium analysis of all of these experiments that had been done, and I think he probably talked about this when he was here. So I'll just say a couple words for people who weren't here. What they did was they took correlation coefficients between the genes across all these different experiments and then arranged them using a force-directed graph in a two-dimensional layout, and then they represented it in three dimensions using VX Insight software, where the height of the mountain corresponds to the density of the genes that were correlated with each other. And what he was able to see from this is that, as you would probably expect, that genes that were, for example, expressed in the germline tended to cluster together. And this was the case for lots of other types of groups of genes. So here's neuronal genes, intestinal genes, muscle, etc. And people have made sort of improvements in the methods to try to look at correlated gene products. But this suggests that a lot of these genes are, in fact, highly regulated and expressed in very specific times and places in the animal, as you might expect. And we know that approximately only half of the genome may be expressed in any particular cell type or tissue. So going back to look at some specific studies that people did, I just want to go over a couple of more examples, one of which is looking at microarray profiles in early embryogenesis. So this is a kind of a study that sort of complements the RNAi work that Fabio was talking about. So Ryan Ba, when he was in Craig Hunter's lab at Harvard, did a microarray experiment where he looked at the first 3.5 hours of development, so early embryonic development through partway through gastrulation. And he took very carefully staged embryos, and he collected samples of them across this time point. So this is one cell, four cell, eight cell, up to the 190 cell stage. And then he profiled the mRNA population that he could find in them. And so this just shows the how far the development has progressed by this time, and you can see that most of the different tissue types already are differentiated by this time. And he could reproducibly detect several thousand genes in each sample. And what he wanted to do was, first of all, to show that the kind of data he was getting wasn't totally crap, he wanted to recapitulate some of the expression patterns that had already been analyzed sort of at one at a time studies. And so if you were here for Joel Rothman's talk, you'll remember that he talked about the system of that's used in the EMS lineage, this set of genes that's important for establishing the mesoderm versus endoderm lineages. And these come on at different times and regulate each other in a cascade that corresponds pretty much to one or two cell cycles. And so what he was able to show is that he saw, basically, he could recapitulate the kinds of patterns that would be expected from this work that had already been done on this cascade. So that's encouraging. And then he looked for different kinds of trends. And what he was able to show using markers that had been studied one at a time again. So this is sort of the era when you're still trying to show that your microarray data makes sense, using examples of things to make sure that you're getting stuff that is good quality data. So it's known that there are some genes that have been characterized, but only a handful to date, that were maternally provided. And people had, again, using single gene studies, established that there are some class that stay on all the time and some that are downregulated in the zygote, except in the P lineage. And so he was able to see these patterns, as well as some transcription factors that were known to be zygotically expressed. And what they did was unsupervised clustering using SOMs to find different patterns of expression across the developmental time points. And what they were able to do was basically see that there were different classes of genes that had different patterns, and that you could see about this time point that there was a general switch in the regulatory program in the animal from maternal control to zygotic control. And this is a general theme that is seen in early animal development. At some point, the maternal products, which drive all the very early divisions, are replaced by zygotic products that then take over the developmental control later. So he was able to recapitulate this. And another thing that he saw was that there are quite a few genes that had a very restricted temporal domain of expression. And many of these came on and were only on for the duration of about one or two cell cycles. So he had two time points per cell cycle. And then these presumably would constitute genes that may be important for, in specific lineages during these specific stages of development, for the differentiation of those lineages. Do you guys have any questions? Are you sleeping? You can take a little nap if you want. Okay, so there are a couple other ways that people can... So this is very good for early development, but what you're looking at is really all the lineages together. And what you really want to be able to do is look at a specific lineage, understand which genes are required in that lineage, and what do you need to make a muscle, for example, or neuron. So there are a couple different methods that people have developed, and these methods, I think, are still being improved upon and are not applicable in every situation. But one of these methods is to use a cell type specific reporter. So people know quite a lot of genes that are required for specific cell types, and you can make a reporter construct that you can express a gene in a specific cell type. So this group was interested in touch receptor neurons, and they had previously done genetic screens for animals that didn't respond when you tickle them with an eyelash. So normally if you touch them with an eyelash, they'll back up, and animals that didn't do that, they were able to identify 10 such genes. They identified sort of a master control gene, MEK3, and another one, MEK17, which they weren't able to clone, and then 8 genes that were dependent on MEK3. And there are only 6 of these neurons in the animal. So they had previously tried to do microarrays where they compared wild type versus mutants in whole animals, and they couldn't get any useful information out of them, probably because their tissue is such a small sample of the total. So what they did was they dissociated late-stage embryos from wild-type or MEK3 mutant animals, and they cultured the neurons on plates for a while. Then they collected all the cells in the culture, and they used a FACS sorter, fluorescence-activated cell sorter, to segregate the fluorescent ones from the non-fluorescent ones. And using in this way, they were able to identify a whole bunch of genes that seemed to be specifically expressed in these touch neurons. And they were able to identify the gene product, for example, for this MEK17, which they had cloned, which they had a mutant for, but they couldn't clone before. They identified a candidate gene and sequenced it and found the mutations in this mutant line. They found a whole bunch more genes that were MEK3 dependent, and they were able then to take, you know, do things like take the upstream promoter region of all the MEK3 dependent genes that they found and identify the putative binding site for the transcription factor upstream and this sort of thing, which kind of game you can play when you have this kind of data. And another method that people have developed, but I haven't seen any other successful studies except for this one, really. Are there a lot of them that people are using poly-A binding protein for? So this is a nice method where you express a poly-A binding protein, again, on a specific reporter. Then you pull that protein down, and then you assay all the mRNA that came down with it. So Peter Roy did this, again, in Stuart Kim's lab, where he hooked up a muscle-specific promoter with this poly-A binding protein that had a flag tag on it, which has a particular monoclonal antibody that recognizes this. So you express this in the muscle cells, and then you pull down the protein, and then any mRNA that this poly-A binding protein is stuck to comes down. And then you can compare this with a reference sample. And so this is what it looks like. So you can see that you have expression specifically in these muscle cells. And then if you grind up the whole animals, and then you pull down the poly-A binding protein, you see that you get an enrichment in the diluted fraction from the poly-A binding protein. These are the antibody bands. And they specifically showed that in the total lysate, but not in the purified fraction, they were able to remove genes that were expressed in other tissues and not in their tissue. So they were very happy with that. And then they went on to do some interesting things. For example, they showed that muscle-specific genes are expressed in clusters in specific locations along the chromosome, and therefore probably certain regions of the chromosome get opened up during muscle development as a group. And so it may be that you get these tissue-specific opening up of chromatin loops during development. I don't know. I think it's pretty strong. There are other methods that people are developing now. I mean, I don't know, like the KD or anything like that. Presumably it could, I would say. But the predominant, poly-A that you see is at the tail. So I don't think it distinguishes, does it, where it is in the message?
But it's like 500 A's, right, in poly-A. So you have them. I don't know what the minimum number of A's is, but it could be a couple hundred.
Yeah, I don't know the details. I think we'll have to go look up poly-A binding protein. I mean, I know in vivo it's sort of associated with a bunch of other things that are involved in mRNA processing and translation. So I don't know exactly what happens when you overexpress it like this in the cell. So there are a couple other things people are doing, and this is just to give you an idea that I think a lot of these techniques are still being developed, and some of them are still in early stages, but I think in the next few years we can look forward to a huge amount of very interesting data that can be used to really understand this problem in a very specific way. So I talked to you about microarray profiling. Chip studies are not a lot right now in C. elegans. I don't know of any published chip studies in C. elegans. I could be wrong. I know people are doing this in a lot of other organisms, and people would like to do this in C. elegans, but that's still something to come along. People are doing one hybrid assays, which it's like a two hybrid system, but you basically just hook up a reporter to a promoter, and then you assay the specific promoter with a library of transcription factors, and you look to see which transcription factors can activate that specific promoter. So it's complementary to ChIP-ChIP in the sense that ChIP-ChIP, you take one transcription factor, you assay genome-wide, you pull it down, you assay genome-wide, but you have to have an antibody for that or a flag tag or something that works. In this one hybrid assay, you take a single promoter and look at all the transcription factors. So people are assembling libraries of transcription factors and then going through them and looking at different reporter constructs. So the thing about both of these methods is you're not really looking at combinatorial regulation yet. You're just looking at single transcription factor, single promoter interactions. Yes?
Do we have any sense of how well that works in these yeast one hybrids? I mean, so I understand that what you measure in the end is that this transcription factor that you express in yeast is able to drive the expression of that fragment in yeast.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean for in C. elegans?
That's a very good question. And I think it's another issue that it's one transcription factor and one promoter, right, in yeast. So you don't really have any idea about what's actually going on in vivo. So what people try to do is they try to complement these preliminary studies with in vivo reporter constructs and show that they're regulated by specific factors, whether, you know, they don't turn, you know, where do they turn, where and when do they turn on? Is it consistent with what you expect? And do you see any perturbation when you try to perturb, you know, the transacting factor? I agree with you completely. But people have to try to develop these kinds of approaches to hope to get, you know, collect the kind of data that they need. But there are always such caveats, and so I think it's very important to be, you know, aware of them when you're thinking about how to use the data, because the data is going to be out there. But you can't just indiscriminately suck up data out of a database and, you know, just start playing with it, right, either. Well, you can.
Yeah, you can. Precisely, I mean, people do.
Wondering. So I think it's important if you're going to work with a particular type of data to understand it, right? To understand the technical issues and to try to understand the quality of the data, what kinds of quality control have been done, what other kinds of complementary assays, you know, have been done or not to try to corroborate it. It's a big issue. And then Fabio also talked this morning about in vivo. In vivo expression profiling. And so he showed you some nice pictures where people have these transgenic lines and they're lighting up different cells. And a number of groups are working on this. And I think Stuart Kim also talked about this when he was here. He's also working on this with Gene Myers. And so I can just also say that the ENCODE project, the ENCODE, NIH, which funded the ENCODE project, which was to characterize 1% of the human genome using a variety of experimental techniques to try to understand functional elements in the human genome, have now decided to back up and try to fund a limited scale of model organism ENCODE. And so what is going to happen is that in the next few years, several groups will be funded to carry out a variety of these different kinds of studies to characterize functional elements genome-wide in C. elegans and in fruit flies. So we'll see what kinds of data collections are going to come out of that. Is there anything else I should say about mod-ENCODE, do you think? So one of these methods that people are using to do in vivo profiling, which I just thought I'd mention because I think it's kind of interesting, and Fabio described a little bit this morning but without pictures, is that Union Biometrica makes this machine called the COPAS, which we just call a worm sorter. But if you want, you could say complex object parametric analyzer and sorter. And basically, you just stick your worms on the top, and if they have a fluorescent tag, they can be separated based on size and fluorescence, just like a regular fax machine. And so this just shows animals of different sizes will come out and different will take a longer time to pass through the laser, and you can sort animals based on their size. And what happens is that if you have a fluorescent signal in the animal goes by the probe, it records the intensity of the signal along the length of the animal. So you don't get any type of cell type resolution using this machine. But you can complement that with looking at the animals and recording in which cell types you see the thing. But an interesting thing about this, and there's a paper that will be coming out on this soon, that's largely the work of Denis Dupree and Marc Vidal's lab. It's a collaboration with a bunch of other groups. So this is the kind of data that you get when you're coming out of the machine, is that you have a mixed population of animals of different sizes. You can sort them by size, and then what they do is they normalize these graphs, which they call chronograms, or post-embryonic developmental chronograms, or PDECs. So they normalize them, and then, well, you can pseudocolor them, but that doesn't really matter. But an interesting thing that you can do with them is then you can take patterns. So they've, so far they have 2,000 in vivo constructs where they've taken, I believe, 2 kb, but I'm not exactly certain if it's a kb and a half, or approximately 2 kb upstream of predicted gene products. Throw them back in the animal, and the way you do this is either by injection or by ballistic transformation, which is kind of cool. So you take a gene gun and you blast gold-covered DNA-covered gold particles into the animals, and they take up DNA, and some of them survive. It's a pretty strong selection. You starve the guys that aren't transformed, and so it makes it easier for you to look later to find the ones that got the transgene inside. But basically, what's very interesting is that you could actually take each one of these rows and line them up in a very long bit vector, and then you can sort of do correlations between the patterns. And so doing this, they've been able to sort of characterize a variety of different patterns of expression profiles without having to do a very laborious detailed analysis, although I think that's equally important. But what it allows you to do is to right away say, oh, we have, so this would look like this, you know, pharynx expression, for example, and then you could look at you know, groups of genes that come on in a similar time and place and how they might differ. And you might see subsets of things that are a little bit different that you could use to like hone in on specific differences that might be of interest to you. And Bob, you also mentioned this morning that a student in his lab is taking, and I'll show you this picture again tomorrow, genes that have been identified as being essential in the early embryo, and then trying to make, she's making protein GFP reporter fusions, and then examining their subcellular localization in the embryo over time in a dynamic way. And this will be really cool because it will really allow us to see really what's going on in the cell at a particular time and place. And then you can do molecular epistatic studies where you can do an RNAi of one and look and see how the distribution of the others affected and how things really interact in a dynamic setting. And then, so I'm getting close to the end. I just want to mention people are also working on making protein-protein interaction maps, largely using these two hybrid, and trying to use some independent methods to corroborate this, like CoIP. And I just want to say that when people talk about two hybrid, it's really a bunch of different techniques that people are talking about. And so high throughput, large scale two hybrid has really evolved a lot since the first papers that came out. And there are now additional methods for doing multiple selections and doing multiple controls and these kinds of things to try to make sure that you get a very high quality data set. And so, for example, the yeast, the C. elegans data set, and this is another lesson in sucking up data from a database indiscriminately. These edges in this map have different qualities attached to them. And so some of them were, say, core or non-core. These non-core things were only found one time, and they put them in as things they found only one time, but that should be regarded with a great deal of skepticism since they weren't really validated. Whereas other ones had been found multiple times in small-scale studies or multiple times in a large-scale study. And some edges actually are generated as enterologs from yeast. So if they're homologs in yeast, and there was an interaction that was known in the yeast homologs, you could infer that there might be an interaction in C. elegans. But if you then try to use this data without knowing the different data types to make an inference in another species, you're actually transporting an inference from yeast to C. elegans to another species, so you have to be really careful about doing that kind of thing. So again, it's really important to understand the kind of data. So I think everyone knows about this system, and if you don't, I can explain it if you want. And an alternative is to try to actually go in vivo, tag a protein, try to immunoprecipitate it, try to pull down all the other proteins that it is, comes in complex with, and then shoot everything to a mass spec, and then try to analyze the fragments that you get and identify the proteins that come down. So this is more reliable in the sense that you really get a picture of what's actually going on in the animal, or unicellular non-developmental model organism. But you tend to get things that are complexes, so that are really things which are always together all the time. It doesn't really allow you to get a clear picture of perhaps transient interactions that you might get a better hold on if you're using a different method. But some really beautiful examples of this, and I'm not going to go through them, are Ian Cheeseman has studied kinetochore structure. Anna Skop took the midbody, and she did this in mammalian tissue culture cell, but then she studied the homologs and C. elegans in vivo. So that's actually a very nice study to combine different techniques in different organisms through homology mapping. And then another thing that's going on is that it seems to be the case that when you do a protein-protein interaction with full-length proteins, a lot of the time you miss interactions that you would see if you just had a small portion of the protein in your assay. So if people do yeast-2 hybrid screens where they do full-length by full-length, they get different results than when they do full length by, say, cDNA library, which is usually primed from the 3' end and often contains partial products. And so people are now going back and chopping up proteins and looking at different fragments of bait proteins in combination with full length preys and vice versa, and then trying to get a better idea, a more complete picture of what kinds of protein interactions are going on. And this is known to be, not just an experimental artifact, but there are a number of proteins that, say, fold up on themselves and only interact with another protein when they open up. And if you use the full-length protein, you won't ever see that interaction. But if you chop it in half, you'll see an interaction of one domain. So, for example, the ERM proteins are like this. They can, in response to a post-translational modification, they'll open up one part will bind to the membrane, another domain will be available for interacting with the actin cytoskeleton, but you'll never get that interaction with the full length. So that's another thing that's going on. But the problem with these protein interaction maps is that you really only see a projection of all possible interactions in all times and places. And so what we're really interested in is to take these and look and see what's going on in different cellular contexts. So I mentioned before, we know only about half of the genes are expressed in any one particular cell type. We also know the same genes are expressed in a variety of different cellular contexts. So these PAR genes are expressed in the early embryo, and they're also expressed in epithelial cells, and we know they carry out important functions in both of these different contexts. But because they're in a different, developmental context, they must have different inputs and outputs and different interactions that they're participating in. So ultimately, we'd like to be able to find out, how these networks are changing and what are the pleiotropic roles of things in the animal. And so, just a last couple of thoughts, which is again that, this is like a projection of all the, this is US Air map in the US in 2003. And this is a picture from NASA that a student of ours found, which I really like, because it really, I think, illustrates this idea that if you look at all the flights that are occurring all day long, you get this kind of picture. But if you start off in the morning and you see where all the flights are going, you'll see that the East Corridor is really heavily trafficked. And then throughout the day, you start to see hubs appearing in the Midwest and gradually further west, until you have California populated. So I think this is sort of like what's going on in a cell, and if we just look at the projection of the whole day, PAR 1 is over here, you're really not going to get a representative view of what's going on. You really have to develop some way to get a dynamic picture of what's going on, and we're, I think, not really there yet, but this is the direction that we would really like to go in. And so what we need to be able to do in some way is to find intelligent ways to take all these different types of information and put them together to get a view of the dynamic genetic networks that are operating in the organism. So basically, you know, subcellular localization, time, I don't know why this is not the best picture, but time and specific organs and things like that. Huh? And so basically, just coming back to the beginning, you know, we're generating all this data. We had to put it together in some way so that we can really start to understand, you know, how development was working. And I hope that, you know, this gives you an idea of the different types of approaches that people are building on that will be coming to fruition in the next, you know, I would say 5 to 10 years that will really make it, you know, provide a great opportunity to be able to do this. So thank you. And if anyone wants to talk about, you know, data or papers or techniques or whether or not you can actually tell if you have a statistically significant interaction, I'm happy to talk to people later about that.
Chris, is it already official which groups are being funded in the MonEncode project and what types of data we might expect from that?
Yes, but I don't know if it's publicly announced.
I actually don't know the groups that are being funded personally.
I don't know all of the groups that are being funded. I know I've talked to some people who say they are being funded, but I don't know the whole set. I don't think it's going to be the same.
The one thing they apparently decided is to hook up projects in elegance and fly. You were telling me this.
Right, I think the one thing that they have said is that they're going to fund a little bit of fly and a little bit of the elegance, because it was possible that they were going to fund only one organism, and then they're going to try to pair up similar problems in the different organisms. It just worked out that way. And so there might be some data coming out that from these projects in the next year or two. They're all going to be very, I think, immediately publicly available to you.
That's what the experimentalists always say.
Well, that's what the NIH is saying. I actually have to say that even though some of these data are completely available, so the RNAi data took 17 people 2 years, which is, you know, something like 30-something years of work to get it together, and these are big projects, and then it's I think people are attached to the data sometimes, and eventually, you know, one or two papers would be nice.
But the human ankle would work this way, so you get, on the test browser, you get all the updates of all the data sets.
Yeah, but you never know if this is really an immediate update or not. Among the data.
Before publication, I'm
sorry. Yes, but even you don't know when they really submit the data to the browser. Database.
To the test browser, you mean? Because there's a code part of the browser and the main browser.
Presumably they say that they do it immediately, but...
You want to know, when did the post out run the jail? Was it two hours ago?
So they mean, do they give a submit before they check data for quality or afterwards?
Have a nice afternoon.